Well, it's an enormous pleasure to have our very own Mark Chwanicki giving the ITP colloquium today. Mark is, of course, well known to the local people here, but for the visitors, just say a few things about Mark. Mark obtained his PhD in 1980 at Stanford with Lenny Susskind, and he was a postdoc at Princeton and at CERN, and then came to UCSB in 1983. He has worked on an enormous variety of fields. He started out in high-energy physics and then moved on to astrophysics. And for the last few years, he's been working on chaos, which he would talk to us about. And not only is he a very eminent physicist, but he's also an outstanding father. He was showing his young daughter how to climb a tree when he fell off and broke his leg. And fortunately, his daughter was well brought up, so that she was actually able to go for help. This was, as I understand, a rather isolated area. So,
I'm not sure how that qualifies me as an outstanding father. Now, this worked in the there we go. Okay. So the title of this talk is Many-Body Quantum Chaos, and I am going to assume that you know nothing about quantum chaos, which I know for many of you is not true, probably a few experts in the audience. So most of a big chunk of the talk is going to be taken up by just an introduction to the basic field of what quantum chaos theory is. It's actually quite a large field, so this is not by no means going to be a comprehensive review, and is going to be strongly biased towards the parts of it that that I've been interested in. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about using some of the results from quantum chaos theory and applying them to many-body systems. This is a field which, or an area of physics which has been growing in the number of people interested in it, but many-body quantum chaos is still a field which is in its infancy, and there's a lot to come in that field, I think. Then I'm going to turn, if there's still time, to what the criteria for quantum chaos are, and what that means will become clear when we get there, and then applying the criteria to many-body systems. So, quantum chaos theory is a field which has gotten input from a variety of other areas of physics. I think we can probably date the beginning of the field from the 1967 papers of Gutzwiller, in which he began to introduce what is now known as the trace formula and the sum over periodic orbits. That was an aspect that grew out of studies of classical dynamics, and that would be a good place to date the beginnings of quantum chaos theory. But it's gotten input from many other fields. Quite a few people who were originally working on quantum chemistry and doing things like trying to figure out spectra of molecules found some of the classical dynamics tools useful and fed into quantum chaos theory. And also, there are close connections to the theory of disordered systems and to random matrix theory. And starting in the early 90s or so, there were a variety of experimental results on various mesoscopic systems, in particular quantum dots, which gave a big boost to the subject of quantum chaos. So, again, starting out at the very beginning, I'm going to just remind you what classical chaos is. And I'm going to be discussing Hamiltonian chaos only. There's, of course, classical dissipative chaos, where you have things like force-damped harmonic oscillators and so on. But I want to talk about Hamiltonian systems, where there's a conserved energy. One of the best studied classical Hamiltonian systems in this subject is the Henle-Hyle system, which is just a particle in two dimensions in a potential which is a starts out as a harmonic oscillator potential, and then there's this perturbation, and so it's just kind of this bumpy thing. Of course, at large enough r, this turns over and rolls off, so you really can't do quantum mechanics with this because everything tunnels out. But you can do classical mechanics at sufficiently low energy, and you just watch the particle rolling around here. So at low energies, again, this is all classical, what you see is something like this. This is a plot of the y-coordinate and the y-velocity, and this is a Poincaré section. That is, we put a dot on here every time the x-coordinate is zero. We put a dot on the y-velocity plane, and they're numbered here, 1, 2, 3, going around, and they all lie on this oval, and you come back around, 27 here, 28. So you just keep going around. This is what happens at low energies. As you go to higher energies, the orbits get more complicated. These pictures, by the way, are taken from a review article by Hanon. And then at still higher energies, you start seeing orbits which do not lie on nice curves. So we see several here. These are all the same energy that lie on nice curves. But all these scattered dots, these are a single orbit. But they start just popping up apparently randomly at different points. And this is an indication that we are starting to see chaotic regions of the phase space, whereas before we were seeing only what might be called integrable regions of phase space.
The scale and these three plots are different.
Are they? I don't think so. No.
Those little dots correspond to a closed orbit, each one of the dots?
No, each one of the dots is a point on the orbit.
Oh, so the particle just sits there?
No.
From point to point.
It just, and if we had numbered them, you know, they would just be popping all around here. It would not, you know, certain.
It's a stroboscopic field.
Right, okay.
And finally, I think just at the energy where you could roll over the edge of the potential, now you see mostly chaotic regions. So this is a subject which has now been intensively studied, and we know lots about it. The chaotic regions and the integrable regions of phase space are fractally embedded in each other, and there are all kinds of fascinating phenomena that happen, not one of which we will discuss. I am going to focus on systems which are fully chaotic, where there is no integrable region in the phase space, at least for some energy range. And several examples of these are known, mostly are so-called billiard systems, where you just have a particle bouncing around in some empty region with hard walls. And most of these have names. There's the Sinai billiard, which is a circle in a square. The Buminovich stadium, which is two straight segments and two semicircles. A cardioid billiard is also known to be chaotic. A periodic array of Yukawa potentials is known to be chaotic. However, I believe there is no known example where you don't have some discontinuity. Here we have the periodic Yukawa potentials, but you know, when I match them, when I go across the period boundary, they meet at a kink. And I've been told by people who should know that there are no known examples of fully chaotic systems with only smooth potentials. But anyway, so it's an artificial example is the point I'm trying to make there. But the reason we want to study them is because it's going to give us a clean test. We want to see what features in quantum mechanics, which is what we're coming to, what features in quantum mechanics are connected to classical chaos, and the easiest way to do that is to study systems which are only chaotic. So here's the first question, which goes back some 30 years or so now that we can ask. Suppose we take one of these fully chaotic classical systems and we quantize it. we can then ask, is there any signature in the quantum mechanics of the classical chaos? How do we know, or how could we know, if we just look at the quantum system, that it was classically chaotic? And now I want to shift gears and introduce something else before I talk about the answer to that question. And that's random matrix theory. So in random matrix theory, we write down matrices, n-dimensional matrices, where, of course, we're going to be interested in the large n limit, where we just choose each element of the matrix at random, here selected from a Gaussian probability distribution, which is analytically the easiest thing to handle. Random matrix theory is, of course, another vast subject which has received a lot of attention from Tony, among other people. But we will just be using the simplest aspects of it. Once you have decided to look at a matrix whose matrix elements have been selected from some probability distribution, you can then ask all kinds of questions. You can pick your favorite object which depends on the matrix and average it over this probability distribution and ask what sort of things you get. Well, a conjecture, which is nowadays most commonly called the Bohigas-Giannone-Schmidt conjecture from a paper they wrote in 1984, is that if you take a classically chaotic system and quantize it and look at its energy eigenvalues, and here I only want to think about bound systems, so I have a discrete set of energy eigenvalues. So I want to look at that discrete set of energy eigenvalues. The conjecture is that those energy eigenvalues will have statistical properties that are in common with the statistical properties of the eigenvalues of a random matrix. And this conjecture actually can be traced back farther than that, although Bohigas, Giannone, and Schmidt were the first ones to state it very clearly, but in earlier work by people like Cassati and Guarneri, Michael Berry, and so on, you can pretty much see the same idea had been floating around for quite a while. So what are the statistical properties of the energy eigenvalues? Well, you've got a lot of eigenvalues, so there are a lot of things you can ask about them. One thing you can ask about is the spacings. Suppose I have some energy, in our high-tech graphics here, I've drawn a set of energy eigenvalues which start at the ground state and go up. And we can ask, suppose I know I have an eigenvalue at some energy, what is the probability that as I move up a distance s for spacing in energy, that I come to another eigenvalue? And this is something you could check experimentally, if you like, by computing the first million or so eigenvalues and histogramming them and see what happens. So the conjecture says that, I'll uncover the whole thing. The conjecture says that if the classical system is integrable, that's the opposite of a chaotic system where everything lies on nice closed orbits, the other extreme. If it's integrable, that the spacing distribution is a Poisson distribution and just goes as e to the minus s. That means that the eigenvalues don't care about each other. If I have one here, it's just equally likely that I'm going to find one anywhere else. This is like an exponential decay law, but now we're exponentially decaying in energy. Of course, the longer you go without finding one, the more likely it is you will find one next. So you just get a Poisson distribution. On the other hand, in a fully chaotic system, the conjecture is that you will get what you would get for a random matrix, which looks like this. There's a power law and then a Gaussian decaying tail. I've left out various constants here which normalize it. Also, of course, you need to measure your spacing in suitable units, and as you go on classically different energy scales, you have to worry that the mean energy spacing is changing, and you have to compensate for that. That's called unfolding the spectrum, et cetera, et cetera. But since this is a colloquium, I'm leaving all that out. This is known as a Wigner-Dyson distribution, going, as you can see from the names, back to early days of physics. Wigner and later Dyson studied random matrix theory, the motivation being complex nuclei. Couldn't write down a good Hamiltonian for a complex nucleus because it's too complicated, so you could try to write down a random Hamiltonian and see what happened. And I didn't bring a transparency of this, but if various nuclear energy levels in various nuclei are fit remarkably well by the random matrix distribution. I guess I haven't said clearly here, this is the result of random matrix theory. If you have a random matrix, this is the spacing distribution of its eigenvalues. The exponent beta depends on what kind of matrices you used. If you used real symmetric matrices, which would correspond physically to having systems with time reversal invariants, then you get beta equals 1, and that's called the Gaussian orthogonal ensemble. And if you don't require the, if you use unitary, sorry, Hermitian matrices, but not real symmetric matrices, which are then diagonalized by unitary transformations, you get beta equals 2, and that's called the Gaussian unitary ensemble. So again, the punchlines are, this is the result of random matrix theory, and the conjecture is that eigenvalues of the quantum Hamiltonian for a system which is classically chaotic will obey that distribution, with beta equals 1 if the system is time reversal invariant, and beta equals 2 if the system is not time reversal invariant. So, as you might expect, by now, zillions of checks have been performed on this for various chaotic systems. Here's a cute one that I like. This is a ball bouncing on a tilted floor and a vertical wall in a gravitational potential. So it bounces like this. And the parameter of importance is the angle of tilt. And classically, this turns out to be a chaotic system if the angle of tilt is anything bigger than 45 degrees, and fully integrable if the angle of tilt is anything less than or equal to 45 degrees. Don't ask me why. I don't have the slightest idea, but that's what it is. Okay, so you can treat that system quantum mechanically. You just solve the Schrodinger equation with the appropriate boundary conditions, which is easy to do on a computer. And here are the results. The name of the spacing has changed from S to delta here for no reason. And here it is at 45 degrees. And here the dashed line is the Poisson distribution, which, according to the conjecture, we expect for an integrable system. And here it is at 49 degrees, and again, this is the beta equals 1 Wigner-Dyson distribution, which we expect for a chaotic system, and you can see how well it's fit.
There's no dependence on the energy of the ball?
Well, I've cheated a little bit. You have to go to sufficiently high energies. The low-lying states are special, and the ground state, you know, is sort of not chaotic in any sense. And so you need to go to a high enough energy, and how high you need to go will be the focus of the last part of the talk, if I get to the last part of the talk.
Is the conjecture that all chaotic systems are being set up by the Wigner-Dyson, or?
Yes.
In the case of electron localization, three-dimensional system, finite system, strong disorder, then.
You have to go, well, in this case, high enough energy would mean that the localization length is big enough that you don't.
Okay, but you can have just a Tychonian model, or you can have all the states
localized. Yeah, if you're talking about fermions, I'm not sure what the right classical limit is, so.
I think the statement is that in the localized region, you have a Poisson distribution.
In the localized region, you would have a Poisson distribution.
But,
yeah.
The way you said things, it sounds like it's not even, it's still just conjecture that there's a Poisson distribution.
I'm not, yeah. There's what I would call an outline of a proof that the chaotic case gives the Wigner-Dyson distribution, which I'll come to later. I'm not I personally have not been that interested in integrable systems, so I don't know what the status of the mathematical status of the integrable case is. Okay, so this is the conjecture, which is, you know, for which there is now overwhelming numerical evidence. But we can go further than the eigenvalue, the energy eigenvalues, and we can talk about the energy eigenfunctions. And here the thing in random matrix theory is to look at the random matrix eigenvectors. So here I have my random matrix H, and I look for an eigenvector. Now this is you don't need to compute the spacing distribution is hard, but it's real easy to compute the eigenvector distribution. Obviously, there's nothing we can say about any individual component of an eigenvector. We just don't know anything at all about it. The only thing we can say is that we want to normalize the eigenvector, and so the only reasonable probability distribution we could write down is something proportional to a suitable delta function which normalizes it, and we can't say anything about individual components of the vector. You have no reason to say that one component is bigger than another or vice versa because they're all the same. So this is the only thing we could write down. If we then ask for the marginal distribution for, say, the first component by integrating over all the other ones, that's a standard calculation, and you just get a Gaussian distribution in X1, which is known as the Porter-Thomas distribution. Well, we could try to apply the same thing to eigenfunctions of a chaotic Hamiltonian. And here I'm going to specialize to billiard systems just because the discussion in a more general system is more complicated, and I don't want to go into it. So if we have a billiard system and we wanted to write down an energy eigenfunction, we know that in the billiard interior, it's just a free particle, and so a plane wave is a solution of the Schrodinger equation, up to worrying about the boundary conditions. And therefore, we might expect that a general solution, or in particular, an energy eigenfunction, which has to vanish on the boundaries, can be written at least approximately as a sum over plane waves with suitable coefficients. Here, the wave vector is all of the same magnitude. That's fixed by the energy eigenvalue we want to have. And this index J is supposed to index the direction of the wave vectors. And so we're going to sum a bunch of plane waves all pointing in different directions with some coefficients and try to get the whole thing, which clearly satisfies the Schrodinger equation in the interior of the billiard, we want to get it to vanish on the boundary. And this, in fact, is how these things are computed numerically, or is at least one method for computing them numerically. Now, Michael Berry, 20 years ago, made a conjecture about these eigenfunctions, and in particular about these plane wave coefficients. He conjectured that the plane wave coefficients should be thought of as being drawn from a Gaussian distribution, which is independent for each coefficient. That is, if we wanted to write... If we wanted a statistical description of a billiard eigenfunction, we would expand it in plane waves, we would look at these coefficients, and the conjecture is that these coefficients would be Gaussian distributed with no correlation among different ones. Well, in the age of computers, that's something else that can be checked. Here is a picture of a billiard eigenfunction. This is in a cardioid billiard, but it's in a cardioid billiard. There's some parameter that describes this. This is one without a cusp. There's a cardioid that has a sharp cusp. That's a fully chaotic system if it has a sharp cusp. If it doesn't have a sharp cusp, then it turns out it's not fully chaotic, but it's almost fully chaotic. Most of the phase space looks chaotic. Anyway, this particular billiard was analyzed a couple of years ago by Bowen Lee and Marko Rodnik in Slovenia, who took a supercomputer and computed something like, I think, 4,000 plane wave coefficients to generate this eigenfunction. This is approximately the 100,000th eigenfunction in this system. And there are maybe something like 250 wavelengths across here. So it's a, you know, it takes quite a bit of supercomputer time to get one of these things. This, I believe, is the highest energy chaotic eigenfunction which has ever been computed. Well, one test of what Berry conjectured is that it's easy to check that if these plane wave coefficients are Gaussian distributed, then so are the values of the wave function. The energy eigenfunction is a real function. If you just imagine histogramming it, turning the area here into little pixels, writing down the value of the wave function on each pixel and histogramming them, you should get a Gaussian distribution. So Lee and Robnik checked that, and this is what they got. This is a plot. This is a histogram of the values of the wave function, or plot it. Value of the wave function is the x-axis here, and a number of pixels rescaled, I guess, to a probability is the vertical axis. And you can just barely see a line passing through here. That's a no-parameter Gaussian. The width is just fixed by the normalization, so there are no parameters here. And the prediction is that the histogram would be a Gaussian, and you can see that that's satisfied to very high accuracy. And incidentally, for physics applications where fully chaotic systems are rare, it's good to notice that this system is actually not fully chaotic. So Berry's conjecture, which was intended to apply only to fully chaotic systems, here we see works quite well, at least that aspect of it, for a system which is not fully chaotic classically, but is mostly chaotic classically, which is what we're likely to encounter in the real world. So that's good. Now you can go farther than that on these tests. Berry also proposed something along the following lines. If you imagine taking the eigenfunction at two different points, x and y, and averaging that over the probability distribution for the plane wave coefficients, it's a short calculation which you probably don't need to bother to look at. The main point is just that the different plane waves are uncorrelated, so this expectation value is just a Kronecker delta. Then a little bit of math, and you see that this correlation function should be a Bessel function. And there's an area of the billiard appears here for normalization. Well, you can also define what we might call an experimental correlation function. Where you take the wave function at two different points, here called x plus a half s and x minus a half s, you multiply it together, and then you average over some domain of x, which might be the entire billiard or might be some piece of the billiard. And then for normalization, we need some areas of the domain you integrate over in the area of the billiard. And the prediction is that that the expected value of that is a Bessel function. And so Berry noticed that in his original paper, and 20 years later, my student Frank Sternoloff and I calculated the second moment. So if you take one of these functions at two different values of s and average that, and subtract off the product of the expectation values of the individual pieces, you get some more Bessel function stuff. But what this contains in it, information about the error. If you compute this experimental function, the expected value is a Bessel function, but you want to know how close you're likely to get. That information is contained in here. If we set both S1 and S2 to S, this is just the RMS variation you would expect in this probability distribution. And it goes like 1 over the linear size of the domain that you integrate over. We could only calculate it for a circle just because the integrals are hard. But that's what you get. And so we did that calculation, and then we emailed Lee and Robnik and said, will you please send us your energy eigenfunction so we can check? And they said, okay. And sent us their energy eigenfunction. So here, what you see is a plot of that correlation function. The solid line here is the experimental correlation function. that you get by when you take the averaging domain to be this circle in the whole billiard, and when you take the point splitting that you do to be along this axis. I mean, there's nothing special about these circles. We just pick those circles to try, and there's nothing special about the direction either. We actually computed zillions of these things. Anyway, the solid line is the experimental correlation function. The gray band is centered on the Bessel function that you expect and has a width whose value is the RMS deviation that you expect. So the prediction is that the solid line should lie within the dashed curve, you know, 68% of the time, one standard deviation. And you can see that that works pretty well. But you can do even better than that, because that formula I showed you contains not only information on the RMS deviation, but also information on the power spectrum of the deviation. You'll notice here that the deviations are all fairly large wavelength. That is, it doesn't quickly zoom from the top, say, of the band to the bottom. It takes, you know, it doesn't do that faster than one wavelength or so. And it turns out that if you, instead of just point splitting in a particular direction, if you also average over the direction that you point split, it turns out that the power spectrum of the deviations is a delta function at zero, which means the following. It means that you're allowed to have deviations, but if you start out here, you start out a little bit high, above one, the power spectrum should has support only at zero frequency, which means this should then just track the edge of the band. It starts at the edge of the band, and then it's supposed to just track it. And you can see that's what happens here. Here it happened to start very close to the center and very close to one, and then it should stay in the center of the band. And that's what happens here. And you can, you know, plot the ratio, and you get ruler sharp lines going across. So this is a very sharp test of Berry's conjecture that those plane wave coefficients have the statistical properties that they are supposed to have. And they do. Let me mention one of the key applications of this in experimental physics is to quantum dots. Quantum dot is, many of you probably know, a blob of amorphous silicon on a plate of something, and you attach some leads to it, and in the regime we're interested in, they're hooked up in such a way that there's a barrier to come in and to come out, so an electron which wants to come in has to tunnel in. So here's a plot in potential energy space. There's a little voltage across here. This line is supposed to be a bit higher than this line, so the electrons want to flow in. There's a potential barrier. There's something called the gate voltage, which basically controls the bottom of the potential. And so you vary the gate voltage, and then you measure the current that flows through here. And the first thing that happens is you see a series of sharp peaks. And what that represents is, to get another electron in here, you have to overcome the electrostatic repulsion of all the other electrons. And it's not going to happen until you get enough energy to do that. Then an electron will pop in. And then you have to wait again till you lower the voltage enough to compensate for the next electrostatic repulsion. So you get a series of peaks, which are spaced by E squared over the capacitance of the dot. But then what you see experimentally is that the peak heights are varied. And I'll show you a real picture of peak heights in a second. But the peak heights vary, and they vary in a reproducible way. So if you sweep the gate voltage back again, you see the same sequence of heights. So it's not some noise phenomenon. And if you were to make up a crude theory of this current, you would come up with something like this. As the gate voltage is lowered, a particular energy level will come into resonance here. And the easiest way for the electron to tunnel in is to tunnel into this particular energy level and then out again. And then, with a little effort, you can convince yourself that the current depends in this way on the amplitude of the wave function near where you've attached the incoming lead and the amplitude where you've attached the outgoing lead. And then, if you assume that psi in and psi out are uncorrelated Gaussian random numbers, That's Berry's conjecture neglecting the Bessel function correlation, which typically we'd like to get, you know, some tens of wavelengths across here, so the Bessel function is small, so you can ignore the correlation. In the probability distribution for psi in and psi out induces a probability distribution for the current, and that should be the peak height distribution. And furthermore, you get a different answer depending on whether you've turned on a perpendicular magnetic field on the dot, which is something they like to do. If you've turned on a magnetic field, that's a non-time reversal invariant system. The wave functions are generically complex, and these are Gaussian random complex numbers. If you didn't put on the magnetic field, the wave functions are generically real, and these are Gaussian random real numbers. And those turn out to induce different probability distributions for the current. Oh, and I should point, this application of quantum chaos theory to quantum dots was done by Jalabert, Stone, and Alhassiad in 92 and was responsible for a big explosion of interest in the field. Here is one of the more recent experiments of Charlie Marcus's group at Stanford, which also includes Art Gossard, who's here. In the inset, you see a sequence of peak heights for a zero magnetic field quantum dot, and they're supposed to be varying randomly. And here, alpha is a suitably dimensionless measure of the current. Here, the points are the experimental histograms of these dots. The solid line is the prediction of the induced current distribution, according to the Gaussian random wave function theory. And for not equal zero, you get a different looking distribution. In particular, near zero current, this one explodes, and this one turns over and actually goes to zero. And you can clearly see this point having turned over in the experiment. So this is a very nice experimental test of this very simple application of quantum chaos theory to what is actually a very complicated system. It's, in fact, a little surprising that it works so well. You can treat the electrons as free electrons, and you can ignore everything else. That just, I think, should be interpreted as supporting the idea that Gaussian random wave functions are fairly common occurrence. Lots of different physics is likely to produce Gaussian random wave functions. It's not something very special to chaotic systems. There's a whole theory of disordered systems which also predicts Gaussian random wave functions. But anyway, there are still some puzzles here. These peaks sure look like they're correlated. If you have a small peak, you're likely to have another one. If you have a big peak, you're likely to have another one. This phenomenon is still not well understood and is controversial. There have been several explanations proposed for it, none of which I want to get into. Okay, so that was the introduction to quantum chaos theory, which has now taken up two-thirds of my talk. I now want to start applying it to many-body systems, which I first want to do, well, I'm going to start out with some more general stuff. I want to think about operator matrix elements. So I want to have some operator, and I'm going to use a very generic notation here. So I'm going to have some operator A, which is just some interesting operator in a quantum system, and I want to take its matrix element between two energy eigenstates. I want to ask what I can figure out about that. Well, first of all, there's something that dates back to the 70s, called Schnirelmann's theorem, which I'm going to be fairly loose about the math here. The expected value of a diagonal matrix element will approach the classical microcanonical average of the classical quantity. So here I'm assuming I have something which has a nice classical limit that I've gotten the quantum system by quantizing a classical system. Mu sub e is supposed to be the Liouville measure on the phase space of that system. X is a generic phase space coordinate. So this is the classical microcanonical average. The theorem is that the diagonal matrix elements tend to the classical microcanonical average. And there's an error which goes to zero as h bar goes to zero. The exponent on the error is not part of the theorem, but it's other non-rigorous considerations expect it to be h bar to the 1/2. And for the off-diagonal elements tend to zero.
What does the green practice mean?
Well, I'm being pretty vague about that right now. If we want to assign them a real meaning, we could go back to Berry's conjecture and say we're averaging over the plane wave coefficient distributions if we had a billiard system, and over their suitable generalizations if we didn't have a billiard system. The theorem, of course, doesn't refer to any of that. What the theorem says is you compute the microcanonical average, you decide on a tolerance, okay? Then you start looking at the expectation values from the ground state on up of the operator. You write them down. You see whether it does or does not agree with the microcanonical average at that energy to within the tolerance. If it does, you put a little check mark. If it doesn't, you put a little X mark. And then you say you want the fraction of check marks to be almost all of them, 1 minus some other tolerance, epsilon. The theorem says there's an energy you can go to such that all but fraction epsilon of the expectation values will agree with the microcanonical average to within tolerance delta. I just wasted 3 minutes of my colloquium explaining. That's what the green brackets really mean. Okay. Okay, so that's a theorem, and real mathematicians have proven it and all that. Getting a little vaguer, the off-diagonal elements we, of course, expect to have expected value zero. That is, you know, is it going to be positive or negative? Who knows? What could it be? It has to be zero. You can also compute the expected value of the square. And here there's something you can do, which was first done by Mario Feingold and Asher Perez 12 or so years ago. Using an argument which I don't want to go through, you can relate these things to the classical correlation function. Here I have the variable evaluated at phase space coordinate x at time 0, another phase space coordinate x at time t, and then I microcanonically average that. That's the classical time correlation function. Then we Fourier transform it, and I'll tell you what everything else in the formula is. E here is the average energy of the two eigenstates. Omega is the frequency corresponding to the difference of the energies. Rho of E is the density of states, which we can evaluate semi-classically using the Weyl formula, which looks like this, which is E to the thermodynamic entropy, which is going to be important in a minute. And so you look at this formula, and the main conclusion is it's got a 1 over rho of E in it. Rho of E is big because it's E to the entropy. And so we conclude that the whole thing is, you can also count h bars, it's order h bar to the n minus 1, or where n is the number of degrees of freedom, or order e to the minus s, where s is the thermodynamic entropy. So in a many-body system, which I am slowly trying to lead up to, in a many-body system, it's real small. That's, okay. And similarly, you can show that the fluctuations in the diagonal matrix elements are real small, and in fact it's the same formula, you just set omega equal to zero, which is the obvious thing to do. Now I should, for people who care about these things, this part is not rigorous. The Schnirr-Elmans theorem stuff, that's real math, and this is, you know, standard physics arguments. With, but
won't take into account something, say, that has off-diagonal long-range order?
No. Right. So we are strictly considering systems with nice classical coordinates and momenta, which we have then quantized. So in particular, we're not really talking about bosons and fermions. Okay. So, the bottom line for the matrix elements looks like this. This equation in the red box I'm going to use a lot in my remaining time. A matrix element, again, this is some generic operator, and we're taking its matrix element in the energy eigenstate basis. The diagonal matrix elements are some nice smooth function, because remember, their fluctuations are really small. And the off-diagonal matrix elements are really small. After taking a square root, they go to e to the minus s over 2. Then there's some envelope function, which is going to sit here. And then there's something I'm going to call R. R is supposed to mean random. And that's some, because we, you know, the actual matrix elements themselves, they're going to wiggle around. Just what else could they do if we take their expectation values in these Gaussian random wave functions? So I have my two energy scales, the average and the difference. S is the thermodynamic entropy, meaning just the logarithm of the density of states. This F is an envelope function, which in the small h-bar limit, which I don't necessarily want to think about, but in the small h-bar limit, it would just be the Fourier transform of the classical time correlation function, but then there'll be h-bar corrections. And R, again, is some erratically varying variable. I've been accosted in the past for using the word random, which has a precise mathematical meaning. It's not really random. I mean, you compute it, but it should vary erratically. I've discovered I can use the word erratically without getting anybody mad. Okay, so I like that equation so much I wrote it down again on the next transparency. And now I want to start thinking about what we can say about these functions. First of all, let me focus on this function A of E. Now remember, here in this little graphic here, here are the diagonal matrix A alpha diagonal matrix elements plotted as a function of E. They're supposed to be smooth because they have fluctuations which are included here that are very small. So there's supposed to be some smoothly varying function which we would expect would vary on scales over which the energy varies macroscopically or classically. So suppose I took those matrix elements and threw in some weight factors and which could be anything I want. Maybe they jitter around a lot, but I want them to be centered on some energy E and cover some width delta E. Well, that's just going to pick out this function at energy E up to some corrections, which will depend on the spread here, delta E, and, of course, up to these really small wiggles that are in these matrix elements themselves. And the point is, I can use any weight factors I want. They can jiggle around a lot, or they can be smooth, or whatever. As long as they're sharply peaked at some energy with some width, I just pick out this function with some computable or estimatable errors. So in particular, I could let those W's be Boltzmann weights. And then over here, what I would be doing is computing the canonical thermal average. And if they're Boltzmann weights, this delta E squared term is over order 1 over n, where n is the number of degrees of freedom. So I would conclude that this function over here is nothing other than the canonical thermal average, where the energy and the temperature are related by the usual thermodynamic formula. Okay. So we know what this function is now. We can compute it using standard statistical mechanics, which is good because that's a computation you might actually be able to do, whereas, you know, computing these matrix elements is something you're not going to do anytime soon. All right. So that's the first result here. The next result I want to think about is I want to think about putting this system, which, I haven't actually set it on the transparency, but I want n to be a large number. I want to put this system in some state at some pure quantum state at some time t, which then looks like this. The alphas are the energy eigenstates. I have some expansion coefficients, and I have my usual time evolution phase factors. And then I want to compute the expectation value of my operator of interest at that time, which I'll just write as a sub t. I mean, we should really put brackets around it, but they're going to be a lot of brackets, so I'll just leave the brackets on. And then, very trivially, you get this formula. And if you now take the infinite time average, I'm just going to average over times. Of course, that just throws away the off-diagonal pieces here. And now I have a sum of these superposition coefficients squared times the diagonal matrix elements. Well, now I go back to this argument that says I can use any weights I want as long as they have a relatively narrow spread in energy. So if my quantum state has a relatively narrow spread in the total energy, remember, E is now supposed to be the total energy of a many-body system, and delta E is the quantum uncertainty in that energy, which typically we, in states we expect to deal with in the real world, should be very small, then this infinite time average is also the canonical thermal average, plus corrections, a bunch of corrections, all of which we expect to be quite small. Well, that's good. That says that if you take an infinite time average of this quantum expectation value, it will be what you would compute using conventional statistical mechanics as a thermal average. If that didn't happen, you would be in trouble because you wouldn't expect statistical mechanics would work. You would want this system to relax to equilibrium, or some such phrase. And if these two things did not match, you would be in trouble. So here we've seen, using the magic equation in the red box up here, that you can actually demonstrate in one transparency that they do match up. Well, you can go farther with this, quite a bit farther, in fact. I'm going to leave out all the details because they get a bit messy, but I'm going to tell you the result. Suppose, what I want to do is I want to look, I guess I'm going to need both transparencies here. I want to look at this expectation value A sub t. Where did it go? A sub t, there it is. The time-dependent expectation value. And I want to just watch it as a function of time. And I want to ask what's going to happen. I want to characterize what happens as a probability distribution for its values. So you can imagine doing this mechanically. You compute the expectation value at some time, you write it down, compute it a second later, write it down, and you histogram all those values that you wrote down and want to ask what you get. And then you could ask more sophisticated questions. You could ask, what do you get if I wait until I get some particular value at some time? Then I can ask, what is the histogram of values at later times given that I have a value at a particular time? Do all kinds of things. And that's what I mean by probability distributions that are induced by dt. I want to have a uniform time distribution. So I have my system which is sitting there, time evolving, and I go and look at it at equally spaced times, and I write down what I see, and I construct probability distributions or histograms from writing down what I see at given times. That's what I mean by a probability distribution induced by dt. And for simplicity, I'm going to assume that my variable has a thermal average, which is zero, which I can do just by shifting it by a suitable energy-dependent constant. So that's just for notation. What do you get? Well, the most interesting distribution you get is this conditional one. I want to ask for the probability that, given that I saw a particular value of this quantum expectation value at some time, that I then see some other value at some fixed later time. And this is the result you can get, and I've made it a little more schematic than it really is for clarity. First of all, for values of these input values, which are not too large, which I'll come to in a minute what not too large means, it's just a Gaussian, and it says that A of t, the value at time t, wants to be just some function, C of t, times the value at time 0. And it really, really wants to be this function because the prefactor here is e to the entropy, which is a really big number. It really doesn't want to be any different than this. And then there's something that sets the overall scale here, which I've called little a squared, which can be defined as the time average of the expectation value of the square of the operator, which is what you would call the size of the quantum fluctuations if you wanted to compute quantum fluctuations. And I'm also going to call those thermal fluctuations because there isn't anything else to be a thermal fluctuation. But never mind. Furthermore, this correlation function is simply related to that envelope function we had earlier, which is simply related to the classical time correlation function, and which in at least some region of parameter space, which I don't want to get into, is something called the Kubo correlation function, which describes the decay of a deviation from equilibrium which is produced by a force. You take the system and you drag it out of equilibrium by applying a force and then let it go, and those deviations decay with the Kubo correlation function. It's the same function, more or less. So I would claim that this probability distribution is a verification of Ansager's postulate of 1931. In 1931, Ansager wrote a paper in which he said, gee, if you have a random fluctuation, it should decay in the same way as if you forced a fluctuation. And that, you know, seems perfectly reasonable, and he used that as input to derive his reciprocity relations and all this stuff. But I'm not aware of any derivation of it from anything except for this. So I would call this a derivation of Onsager's postulate, all of which, of course, I've skipped, you know, lots of steps, but I claim you can derive that from the magic red box equation with relatively minor hand waving. So here's a picture which may be a little clearer of what's going on. Here is the expectation value of some operator A as a function of time. Here's its thermal expectation value, which is no longer zero. That expectation value fluctuates around the thermal value, but with very small fluctuations. These are not thermal fluctuations. These are way too small. These go like e to the minus s. But every so often, you might get something big that happens. You have to wait a really long time. You have to wait e to the s before this, you know, years before this happens. But maybe it'll fluctuate up. And the prediction is that if it does, it fluctuates back both up and down, actually. It goes up and down with the Kubo correlation function here. And the scale for this is set by the ordinary thermal fluctuations or quantum fluctuations, whatever you want to call them. Try to line it. It's a random curve, so it doesn't really matter if I line it up. Okay. Which is given by the expectation value of the square of the operator in question. You take its quantum expectation value, you take the square root. And so those are the characteristic size of the thermal fluctuations. That Gaussian only applies if this fluctuation that you actually want to look at is not real big compared to those. If it's real big, then it goes nonlinear and you can't compute it without doing a lot more work. But if it's not too big, then it follows the Kubo result. So you also get out of this a domain of validity of linear response theory, which is something that's a little tricky to get otherwise. Okay. Well, so in 58 minutes, I have done the first two parts of my talk. I will be very brief on the rest. Oops. Take off two transparency. All along, I've been assuming things like that magic red box equation. And I've been assuming that I have a system which is classically chaotic. But classical chaos alone is not good enough. For example, if we wanted Gaussian random wave functions, it's obvious that the ground state of a system is not Gaussian random. The ground state is some nice smooth function with no nodes and all that stuff. It's not Gaussian random. So we have to go to some reasonably high energy. How high do we need to go to? Well, that's a subject which on which there is a vast literature, and I'm only going to tell you the result. If you look at the mean energy level spacing, delta, which is a function of energy, it, you know, the density of states varies with energy. This is basically the inverse of the density state. You define a time related to that, which is called the Heisenberg time, and you compare that to a classical time, which is we'll call the Thouless time, which is a little tricky to decide exactly what it is. For a diffusive system, it's basically the time it takes for whatever is diffusing to diffuse across the whole system. Quantum chaos requires that the Thouless time be much less than the Heisenberg time. And this was something which was discussed in very early work of Cassati and Guarneri and their collaborators, and has become more and more formalized as time goes on. Physically, it's just saying if something is going to diffuse, it had better be finished by the Heisenberg time. Because the Heisenberg time represents the time at which quantum physics becomes quasi-periodic. If you look, you know, time-evolving wave functions with just the phase factors in front of the energy eigenstates, those start cycling back to what they were at the Heisenberg time. So after the Heisenberg time, a quantum system refuses to follow classical equations. It starts, it's come back to something close to its initial state and is doing quantum stuff. So the classical stuff had better be finished by then, or the quantum theory doesn't know about the classical stuff. This is, you know, obviously should not be sent to FizRev letters, but that's what's going on. Okay, so a couple of years ago, Anton Andreev, who was a postdoc here, Odette Agam, Ben Simons, and Boris Altshuler wrote what I consider to be a very important paper in which they gave a precise definition of the Thouless time and derived this condition, modulo some hand waving that they had to do. But What they identified it as is the smallest non-zero eigenvalue of the Perrin-Frobenius operators, which is the thing that propagates densities on phase space. It's a classical thing, not a quantum thing. Have a density on phase space, you want to time evolve it. You time evolve the individual trajectories and watch what happens to the density, but you can time evolve the density directly, and by solving Liouville's equation, the operator on the space of functions on phase space, which time evolves the densities, is called the Perrin-Frobenius operator, and it's a real delicate thing mathematically. Because if you have a chaotic system and you start with some nice blob on phase space and let it go, you know area is conserved, but you also know it wants to spread out over the phase space. So it turns all filamentary and you know spreads these little tendrils around. And in the time goes to infinity limit, it turns into some horrible fractal thing. And you may or may not want horrible fractal things in the space of functions you allow yourself. And depending on exactly what kind of functions you allow yourself, this operator may or may not be unitary. It's formally unitary if you allow yourself all the horrible fractal things. But if you start throwing some of them away, if you imply any smoothness conditions at all, then eigenvalues move off the unit circle and onto the real line. And the one that's closest to zero here is the thing that they want to identify as the inverse of the Thallus time. Now, there's lots of caveats because, first of all, in many real systems, there's a cut here, and there's not an eigenvalue, and all kinds of horrible things happen. But never mind. It's a really brilliant paper, I think. And I'm not even going to begin to tell you how they did it. But, okay, so what is the bottom line? That's the criterion. It's been, and both these things are energy dependent. So this gives you a criterion on the energy, and as you might expect, it's not satisfied for low energies and is satisfied for sufficiently high energies. The problem is, in a diffusive system, which really means a system with disorder in it, and if there's disorder, we can average over the disorder, and then we can compute these things, and blah, 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 it's not so hard. If you have a real chaotic system with no disorder that you're going to average over, you would actually like to compute the smallest non-zero eigenvalue of the Perrin-Frobenius operator. Unfortunately, nobody has the slightest idea how to compute any eigenvalue of the Perrin-Frobenius operator, because it's such a horrible thing. That's not quite true. There are, you know, caricatures of dynamical systems where you can compute it. I don't think it's known for any real system. So you have to do something else. And I'm going to just tell you what my student, Sanjay Hordakar, and I have been trying to do based on, I'm not going to go through all this, don't worry, based on another brilliant paper by a young physicist in Novosibirsk named Silvestrov, he was considering fermions with random single particle energies and random two-body matrix elements. And what he said was, to get quantum chaos, you should first of all compute the density of pairs of two particle states in which both particles are occupied, and simultaneously you have two other unoccupied states, and that's some awful formula, which ends up being some temperature. And by temperature, what I really mean is something which is related to the energy by the usual thermodynamic relation. It's just more convenient to use a temperature. He said you should compute that, and you should compare that to the two-body matrix element, and if that's bigger than one, then you should have quantum chaos. And let me not... That's sort of reasonable. You want the scattering to be strong among these states so they all get mixed up. Okay, so this is some computable thing. What Sanjay and I said was, well, we want to consider, you know, fermions in three dimensions which are bouncing off each other with some S-wave scattering length A. And the bottom line is that if you apply that criterion to a dilute gas of fermions, there's more complicated stuff, which I won't show you on the top. For a temperature measured in units of the Fermi energy has to be much bigger than, first of all, something that depends on the S-wave scattering length A, measured in units of the interparticle spacing. As A goes to zero, of course, the system becomes non-chaotic, so this has to blow up as A goes to zero, and it turns out to blow up like A to the minus one-third. But the big punchline is there's an N to the minus two-thirds which sits here. That means you don't have to get very hot before the system looks chaotic. It meets the criteria for quantum chaos at temperatures which go to zero in the thermodynamic limit. So all that magic red box equation stuff works at extremely low energy, provided all the stuff that leads up to this is correct. And you get an even more complicated thing that happens with bosons. If you look at a dilute gas of bosons, now I'm just going to show you a picture. Here's the temperature measured in units of the Bose condensation temperature. Now you have to do two calculations, depending on whether the dispersion relation for the bosons is the low temperature relativistic dispersion relations of sound waves on the Bose fluid, or the high temperature particle-like dispersion relation. This isn't really a sharp line, of course. I just drew it that way. Then you get two different criteria, and you should have chaos anywhere above this blue line, which has these two different forms. And again, you know, this should really be some smooth curve here. But again, goes to zero like n to some negative power, which comes out to be minus 3/13 over here. I tried to connect this to the 26 of string theory, but I couldn't get it to work. Okay. There's some more stuff going on there, but I'm out of time, so I'll stop there. Let me just give my conclusions for quantum chaos applied to many-body physics. First of all, I tried to show you that a lot of standard results of statistical mechanics can be derived from my magic red box equation, which comes out of quantum chaos theory, which I think is nice. I think it's sort of a matter of taste or opinion whether you think Ansager's postulate is simple enough in its original form that you should just believe it and not ask any questions about it, or whether you should try to derive it from something else. I think it's nice to derive it from something else, and that's what I tried to do. Then a question of when does quantum chaos work? When is it applicable? I believe it's a general result that the energy threshold for quantum chaos will actually go to zero in the thermodynamic limit, like some power of n, where the power depends on the system. There's some other results in the literature which indicate this for collections of harmonic oscillators non-linearly coupled, for example. And an open question is, again, all of these things were, quote, derived, to the extent they were derived, assuming that the system was classically chaotic, and we would really like to know how much classical chaos is really necessary. The study of real systems with mixed phase space is in its infancy. Very little is known about them. But I think experimental results like quantum dots and some of these results indicate that you probably don't need too much classical chaos. But if you have some chaos, it's probably enough. Like that cardioid billiard was not really a chaotic billiard, but the wave function satisfied Berry's conjecture to very high precision anyway. So this is a very important open question. What do you really need? What are the real ingredients to derive any of these things? And I'll stop there.